Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Darsha Narvaez. She's Professor Emerita of Psychology at the University of Notre Dame, Fellow of the American Psychological Association, the Association for Psychological Science, the American Educational Research Association, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Born in Minnesota, she grew up living around the world as a bilingual, bicultural Puerto Rican German American who calls Earth her home. Her earlier careers include professional musician, business owner, classroom music teacher, classroom Spanish teacher, and seminarian, among other things. In her academic career, she employs a lifespan interdisciplinary approach to studying evolved morality, child development, and human flourishing, integrating anthropology, neuroscience, clinical, developmental, evolutionary, and educational sciences. She hosts evolvednest.org and is president of kindredworld.org. You can see her six-minute movie, which is www.breakingthecyclefilm.org, www.breakingthecyclefilm.org. She has numerous publications, including books such as Indigenous Sustainable Wisdom, First Nation Know-How for Global Flourishing, and the 2022 Restoring the Kinship Worldview, Indigenous Voices Introduced 28 Precepts for Rebalancing Life on Planet Earth, and the forthcoming The Evolved Nest, Nature's Way of Raising Children and Creating Connected Communities, written with Gay Bradshaw. A recent book, Neurobiology and the Development of Human Morality, Evolution, Culture, and Wisdom, won the 2015 William James Book Award from the American Psychological Association and the 2017 Expanded Reason Award. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. Second, thank you for being on the program.
Appreciate being here with you. Thank you, Derek.
So for the first question, would you rather talk about, just sort of introduce us to the new book, The Evolved Nest, which I think is great, by the way, or would you rather talk about the book's genesis story?
Well, I can tell you how it came about. I've been looking for ways to explain to the public, the general public and not just academics, the importance of the evolved nest. And it's hard to do that without sounding like you're shaming parents. The evolved nest is about a community support system. It's not just about what parents do with kids. It's the whole community is involved. As our species evolved, that's how we became to be such a social creature, to have such large brains for our social intelligence. So I was looking around for a way to enter the minds of the public in a way that wouldn't be so threatening, so parent focused, right? And so Gay and I had some conversations, and it just seemed like a good fit to bring up animal nests and then integrate the human evolved nest into our discussions about each animal's nest.
So can you explain to me how it would be considered parent shaming? Because I think that raising children by oneself, well, I'll back up a second. My next book that I'm going to work on, that I'm going to start very soon, is going to be about helping my mother die. And I was taking care of her pretty much by myself. And this is not how elders should be taken care of by themselves. There should be an entire community. And that's what that book's going to be about, is how it really takes an elder. I mean, it takes a community to help people through that passage. And I don't know. I don't think that's shaming individuals to say you can't do it by yourself. And I would think it would be the same with parents. It's not shaming them to say, good grief, raising children all by yourself is not how we evolved.
Yeah, that big picture point, right? The take home message is, yeah, not so shaming. It's the details to say that we should have, breastfeeding is really important for brain and body development, for the immune system, and several years of it, that's our species normality. And without it, you have all sorts of issues, health issues, such as obesity and heart disease, and even mothers with breast cancer, if they don't breastfeed, and so on. And then there's affectionate touch and being responsive and being physically present with a child, with a baby, 24/7, which means you're carrying the baby around. Your baby's always in arms somewhere. And because we isolate mothers and force them into caring for a child by themselves, which is insane, just like elder care at the end of life. The mothers take it as an affront to their ability to parent because you're now telling them they did it wrong. So that's the shaming part. Well, and they're so stressed these days, parents and families, mothers especially. COVID showed us that too. They can barely hang on, and now I'm telling them that they should be breastfeeding and they should be carrying their children around and be more responsive and not leave them alone to cry or isolated in a crib and all this stuff that's contrary to the dominant culture's way of raising children.
Well, thank you for that. And I hear you. And the truth is that the mother shouldn't be carrying them around 24 hours a day, because it should be the mother's carrying them around for many hours, and then the grandmother, and then there's the auntie, and then there's the uncle, and then there's the cousin, and then there's a brother, and it should be a larger community. So
Right.
I hear your point about how somebody could take this as shaming, but it's really like you can't do it all. I mean, you can't do that. It's like shaming somebody for not being able to fix their car while they're changing diapers while they're, doing everything else. Like, you can't do everything.
Yeah, but we've told mothers they can, so and they should, right? So the cultural myths are just prevalent everywhere. And that's part of patriarchy, to force all everyone except the people at the top to have to work their fingers to the bone and try to exist by their fingernails day to day with lack of support. So we don't have parental leave in this country in the US. It's insane. So moms have to go back to work in 2 weeks after birth or maybe 6 weeks, but that's just not a way to raise a child to be healthy and happy and cooperative. Instead, you're raising children to be uncooperative, to be dysregulated, to be self-centered and aggressive. That's just what happens because we're so malleable in early life. We need that 24/7 community support system that we evolved to have.
So I was going to ask you to sort of talk about evolved nest, both evolution and nest, but you said self-centered, and can you make the connection for us between this lack of communal attention, let's put it that way, so we're, clearly not shaming the mothers, but this lack of how that leads to self-centeredness later.
Right. So our bodies are very immature at birth. Full-term birth, only 25% of the brain, adult-sized brain, is there. Most babies are not allowed to stay in the womb long enough anymore. They're taken out early because they guess at birth due dates and cesareans and all this stuff. So we even have less mature brains at birth for many babies now. And that brain is ready to be can have a continued external womb experience. We're born early because our heads get too big otherwise, and we'll kill the mother with a big-headed baby. So the baby's expecting to have that external womb experience, which means that their needs are met immediately, just as in the womb, that they're kept calm, they're kept connected physically to caregivers. And without that, well, during that time period, all sorts of systems are establishing the parameters and thresholds for how they're going to function. So that's the oxytocin system, people know that one, or the stress response system, or the vagus nerve, which innervates all the major systems of the body, also the immune system. All sorts of systems are deciding how they're going to work. And when you leave babies in distress, which means untouched, alone, unresponded to appropriately, not fed what their body expects, you're going to have dysregulated systems. And when you're dysregulated, you can't be cooperative. It depends on every baby's different in how they're developing, so you can't really predict exactly which system's going to be underdeveloped or misdeveloped or how. But you're not going to have a good stress response, for example. If you've been distressed a lot as a baby, you're going to be more threat reactive. You're going to easily move into the stress response. That means that your blood flow shifts away from your higher order thinking. That's what it does. It mobilizes you for action, for fighting or flighting, And then you just can't cooperate in the moment because you're just so oriented to your immediate needs. And so you get more self-centered that way. You're not able to relate. The other thing that happens, so there's all sorts of things I could talk about because my area is morality. It also affects your moral development and your orientation. But let me just say what's supposed to be developing in the evolved nest is all this social capacities, relational attunement, and being able to, do all the nonverbal ways of communicating. That's what develops before language. Probably hundreds of capacities. And so when you're not nested, you don't develop those things too. So you're not only dysregulated physiologically, you're dysregulated socially. You don't know how to get along, and then you're awkward and you can't read signals or convey your emotions appropriately, and on and on. It's so complicated.
This is reminding me of, I've read and written a lot about trauma and how that affects people for the rest of their lives. And I remember something that a psychologist friend of mine said to me decades ago about how even the sociopaths were made into sociopaths by trauma. Their behavior makes sense within the traumatic situation
Right.
of, basically shutting down all connections. You're going to do that if you're completely powerless, and if and then the dysfunction really comes later when they're no longer powerless, but they continue, those neural pathways have been created. And is it fair to talk about not growing up in the evolved nest as a form of sort of chronic trauma or chronic, semi-trauma or something? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I call it undercare. It's really neglect, and neglect we know is a legal term though, but we know it has all sorts of negative effects. The brain is just don't grow. The kids have smaller brains when they're neglected, for example, because all the stuff that's supposed to be growing doesn't have the stimulation it requires. But chronic trauma, I would probably agree with you, but I can't say that. People really get upset if I talk about that. They don't want to know that we're animals. We are social mammals. We have certain needs, especially in early life, that have to be met in order for our human nature to grow properly. People don't believe that. They think, oh no, it's just genes. It doesn't matter too much what you do to kids. They're resilient. They're gonna. It doesn't affect parenting. Isn't that important? That kind of thing is just pervasive. They are more affected by peers than their parents. Well, that's because we put them in same age classrooms for how many years, and they don't have anybody else to rely on, right? That's abnormal. We evolved to be living in multi-age communities, not in, peer groups alone with the same age, anyway.
I have a friend who helps to rescue prairie dogs, and if they're gonna, they're gonna put in a mall, and she will try to stop the mall, but if she can't, she will relocate the prairie dogs to another place. And she said one of the colonies, got predated down to one prairie dog, and then recently another prairie dog has come from somewhere else to join that group, and we all recognize that it's the prairie dogs. I mean, we think it's crazy to have a prairie dog that's living by him or herself, but we don't recognize that humans as well are social creatures. I mean, that sort of seems to be the nub of it, isn't it?
Yeah, and our biology is shaped by our social experience in early life. Humberto Maturana, a Chilean biologist, talks about the biology of love, that we need that loving, what I call nest, in order for our biology to grow properly. And when we don't have that, we're gonna we we're he's worried that we're changing our species even from a loving species, Homo sapiens hominis, to an aggressive or arrogant species, Homo sapiens arrogans or Homo sapiens aggressans, right? So We know we're biosocially constructed by our experiences. And every minute, every few minutes, the baby's a different baby. And so they need that nested care because you don't know what you're undermining, what development you're undermining if you leave them alone or leave them in distress.
So you've pretty much defined nest and evolve, but can you sort of bring all that together? And then after that, let's talk about some of the non-human groups that you talk about in the book.
Sure. So our species is 2 million years old, the Homo group. Homo sapiens speciation is about 300,000 years old. But our way of raising children, this collective child raising, which is called cooperative breeding by Sarah Herdy, the great anthropologist who pointed this out with lots of evidence across species and all, how different we are. We create with our cooperative breeding our ability to mind read one another, and we let others mind read us, this intersubjectivity, and how that has made us so successful as cooperative creatures with our one another, but also with other animals until recently, until the last couple few thousand years. And so we evolved to be, we're part of the social mammal lineage, which is around 30 million years old. There's guesses that 20 to 40 million years. But a lot of the practices that are in the nest are actually shared with other animals. So it's not just humans and not just social mammals. A lot of them are cross-species characteristics. And so each species has its own particular nest. Social mammals have sort of a set of practices, and ours are very much in attuned with that, except we add multiple adult caregivers, so allo parents or allo mothers, that it's a community support system. In other apes, it's just mom that takes care of baby, and they're very untrusting of others because there's some infanticide that can happen and so on. But not our species. Our species evolved to share that child raising, and that's why we have big brains, because moms can't get enough calories on their own to give to that child as they're growing up.
I just want to go this way a little ways, and then we'll come back to the nest. But it seems to me that, having evolved in groups of, I don't know, let's say 50 to 150, is one of the great unspoken tragedies of modern society that we that living both in numbers larger than 150 and also in small groups that are much less than 50 has affected us on every level conceivable.
Well, I think our nomadic foraging cousins have more flexibility. They're in and out of groups. They, from one day to the next, the size of the group is different, and they'll come together. At least there's archaeological evidence. These hunter-gatherer groups would come together maybe once a year for group hunting or fishing or celebrations, and be really in hierarchical settlements for a while, and then go back to their egalitarian small groups. So I think there's more flexibility than we think. And then I think that it's hard to say, there are a lot of traditional societies that have followed the evolved nest components who were settled until, colonization and all took over their lives, globalization. So I can't say that it's a tragedy to move away from those numbers. It's part of our heritage to be oriented to centralizing child development, the maternal or matrilinear, matrifocal societies of our past, and they're still in existence. But it's patriarchy and patriarchal capitalism that's really undermined a lot of it. So, anyway, I should say a little bit more about the NEST. The nine components that we study in my lab include soothing perinatal experiences, which are the a welcoming pregnancy. The mother feels supported while she's pregnant, and so the right biochemistry is being fed to the child in the womb because the mother is pretty at ease and relaxed and supported. And then at birth is a soothing too. It's not forced, it's not painful to the baby, except in the natural ways where there's the flow of hormones that keep the mom and baby from feeling very much pain when it's naturalistic. And then no separation of mom and baby at birth, and no painful procedures like infant circumcision in those early days. And then breastfeeding for several years. Our species expects 4 years on average. It ranges. That's because the immune system takes that long to develop, at least, and for other reasons too. Or actually, our jaws meet. There's evidence now that they have European skulls from like 300, 400 years ago when textile factories started and mothers started to go leave their babies behind and not breastfeed as long and go work in the factories. And they can see that the jaws have shrunk since then compared to those skulls with our skulls today. And so we have all these sleep problems and orthodontic problems and such. So there's a lot of different factors. So that's soothing perinatal experiences, breastfeeding, welcoming social climate starts from pregnancy and throughout childhood and throughout our lives. Then there's affectionate touch, so 24/7 for a baby, and lots of affectionate touch otherwise. No negative touch, no spanking, no pinching, slapping, none of that. And moving touch too for babies. They need that, a lot of movingness to develop their brain and body well. Helps them digest, for example. And there's self-directed play with other multiple age playmates. That's building the brain capacities too for getting along with others and helping you learn to stop and start action, to pay attention to your playmate, because if you're too aggressive, they'll stop playing with you. So you want to learn, to control your actions and so on. And then there's responsive relationships. So in babyhood, that means that you're kept calm all the time while your brain is growing so quickly. And throughout life, you need responsive relationships and allo parents, multiple mentors to help you along all the way throughout life. And then nature connection, nature immersion and connection so that you feel connected to the natural world. You never feel alone because you've got relationships with the trees and the animals and the plants around you. And finally, the routine healing practices where you can rebalance your body, your brain, your psyche, your relationship to the natural world and all. So these are the practices we see in nomadic foraging communities. The San Bushmen, who have been around for 150,000 years or more, and our genes all relate to them. They do these things still today.
The thing about the multiple, the allo parenting reminds me of something that happened, I think was really good for me when I was a teenager, which was, or a late child, early teen, that both of my sisters had fairly active dating lives. And I have since learned that this is odd, but it was great that many of these ex-boyfriends of my sisters would become friends of the family. And then, they would stop dating my sister, and then they would still hang out with the family for 5 more years.
Cool.
And this a lot of times, I mean, they took me to soccer games, took my hockey games, took me hiking. And so I had, essentially, I don't know, 15 uncles through that time.
Wow.
And it was, I often think about the lessons that they all taught me, both implicitly and explicitly. And yeah, it was a wonderful part of my upbringing.
Really? Wow.
Okay, so let's talk about, we haven't really brought non-human animals into this yet. So let's talk about, I mean, much of the core of the book is is talking about different non-humans and how that relates to the whole evolved nest in humans. So can you just choose one or two of those that you may want to talk about to start with?
Well, let's start with the allo parents, allo mothers, because that's such a key part of our conversation. So, emperor penguins, the mother has the egg, but then hands it off to the father for several months while she goes off to feed in the ocean. And so he's here we are in the freezing cold Antarctica, and the father is keeping that egg warm under his feathers at his feet, right? Holding the, I think people may have seen films now. But he doesn't do it by himself. All the other fathers are right there. They're all huddling together for months, and they move in and out of the circle so that the ones on the outside can get warm on the inside, and the inside people or penguins move outside, you know, and keep shifting. And then finally, the mother comes back after months of being away, and then the father goes off. So he has to transfer the egg to her, and then the father goes off to feed. So there's just this wonderful communal partnering care of the young.
That's great. Can you do another animal?
Sure.
Do you want to, whichever one you want to do. There's bears, there's elephants, octopus, sperm whales. So wherever you want to go is great.
Sure. Well, sperm whales, we focus on breastfeeding there. The whale baby breastfeeds alongside the mother in the water, of course, right? So it's a different environment. Each animal has its own unique space on the planet where they have evolved and meet the needs of their young, however works best for that environment. And what's interesting also about the whales is that the mother starts to whistle a particular song for that young one that's coming. And all the other whales don't whistle during that time so that the young one can learn that song. And then after birth, they're all singing or whistling that song to the young. And it's just so wonderfully, again, communal. Another communal one is the elephant. So the mothers, the elephant group, the band moves across space together. And when the mother's ready to have the young, the newborn, she'll stop and everyone will know it's happening, right? And they'll gather around and then reach out with their trunks to help that young one out and then to stand up, because they can do that pretty quickly. And it's again a nice nest of multiple ages of elders and younger elephants that are there to be welcoming and accompanying the mother and the offspring.
Times you've mentioned the importance of multi-age connections. Can you talk more about that, please?
Sure, for humans, there, you know, you can see this in Native American communities, at least the ones before conquest, pre-conquest communities, where the elders were the ones who took care of the young, now the very young children, in part because the parents were off gathering food or hunting, and taking care of the larger community issues, perhaps. But the elders and the young are very similar in their ability to kind of tune into this the non-manifest realm, the spiritual realm. They're much more young children before age six or so are they can have imaginary friends. They have a sense that everything's alive around them, and then we kind of beat it out of them as they go to school and make them force them into their left brain, essentially. So the right hemisphere, I think, probably is more active in the elders as well, because they are, getting ready for the transition to through death into a new life, and they are less concerned about their own identity. So one of the issues about having children being raised only by parents is that if they're young parents, they tend to be oriented to, trying to meet the cultures in today's world, the culture's ideals of what a child should act like. So they're much more harsh with their children than an elder would be. And so it's better to have the elders, at least in the traditional societies, taking care of the young. And for playmates, then it's really important for a child to have multiple ages because, for one, when you're an older child and you're with a younger child, you have to adjust to the limits of that younger child's abilities. And so you do that in our pre-conquest societies that, young children are welcome to be playing with the elders and the older kids. There was no issue about that. And then the younger love to look up to the older kids because they, can learn things from them rather than being put with the same age group where there's nothing to learn much except to take risks together because they don't have any more experience than you do, primarily. So the other thing about having multiple caregivers or multiple playmates is you have to learn to adjust to individual differences of all kinds. And that's building your flexible attunement, which I is central to being a human being, to our moral capacities to be socially engaged wherever we are, whomever we are with, to be able to relate to them and adjust and develop an interpersonal dance that's unique to that moment with that person. So those are the kinds of things that our brain is ready to learn. And that, unfortunately, we often undermine in the way we the life course of children today.
A couple times you've mentioned play, and you talk extensively in the book about free play. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so self-directed free play means the child's in charge and it's whole body immersed, rough and tumble play, climbing trees, playing chase. It's social, ideally, but you can be social with the natural world too. So it doesn't have to be just with other humans. And this is going to develop all sorts of brain capacities. It turns genes on of all kinds that are positively important for developing self-control, executive functions, controlling your aggression, being able to have develop your foresight and your ability to plan and to shift gears to change course. So it's something that we don't see very much today. Unfortunately, for the last, I don't know, decades, parents have been more oriented to organizing play dates, to putting children into organized sports, and then from one to another, right? Organized, dance, then soccer, then than baseball, than all these things that children don't have the free play that they really require. And the other part is that free play should be occurring in the natural world so that you're learning about the tree and how to climb this tree versus that tree, how to cross the creek, how to honor the insects around you or the animals. So we have really denigrated or to the nest, well, and every component has been degraded in the industrialized capitalist world. And play is one of the things that can actually remedy earlier undercare, lack of nestedness, because when you play in the moment with another person, free play, your right hemisphere is growing, your right brain, even though maybe it didn't when you were young because you didn't have those experiences of support. Now you can play. This is true for adults too. Whatever keeps you in the present moment, you have to keep reacting and developing a sense of communalism, of relational attunement. That's going to grow your right hemisphere. It's going to increase your empathy. It's going to increase your self-control. It's going to increase your capacity for higher consciousness to feel oneness with the cosmos, for example. It's all right brain stuff. And it's the kind of thing that industrialized civilization has undermined for some time.
I think it's true for many people of my age. I'm 62. Much of our summer childhood experience consisted of our mothers saying, "Go outside and play," and then us getting together as a group of kids and basically coming back at lunch and leaving again and coming back at dinner and doing exactly what you're talking about, spending all our time in the irrigation ditch and the thickets and the and I mean, those were the best memories of my childhood.
Yeah.
And another thing I've read about this, I mean, I don't know what your experience was with this, but my own, there are things I did as a kid that are completely terrifying now, like climbing way, 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 way up in trees. And I was talking to somebody a while back that said that part of that is we learn how to regulate fear through that children sort of do that all the time, putting themselves in somewhat scary situations, and they learn that a lot of fear, a lot of things that they're afraid of end up not being so scary.
Yeah, this is something that Jean Leloff, if you know her. She wrote a book called The Continuum Concept, about her experiences in the Amazon with the Yaquana back in the 50s. She didn't write her book, or it wasn't published till the 70s. She was trying to convince Americans that you don't have to be monitoring your child all the time, because you actually undermine their self-confidence when you say, "Oh, watch out, don't do that," to the toddler, right? And you've now deflated them, their motivation. We're animals. Animals don't fall into holes and stuff. You know, I mean, they're able to, young animals can take care of themselves most of the time. It's when you start to undermine their confidence that they start to question their abilities, and then they kind of shut down, and then they do have accidents. But it's interesting what you say about the dangerous activities. That is something that's really important for developing that sense of, you know, I can do this. I'm capable. I can manage on my own. Forced kindergartens are becoming more prevalent now. And there's a film, and I forget the name of the, I think it was in Denmark, of a forced kindergarten school where a journalist is coming in to find out about it. And he sees a child, a little young, this is kindergartners, right? Way up there, I don't know, 50 feet high, and maybe not, I'm not a good judge, but the child is way at the top of a tree, and the tree is swinging back and forth. And the interview says, "Do you ever have any accidents?" And the director says, "Oh, we had one once a few years ago. A parent ran over the foot of a child in his car, you know." So the adults have become so afraid. Part of that is from their unnestedness themselves and their parents warning them about everything. It's also the social media and the media in general. You know, "Oh, there's a kidnapping going on," you know, even though that the safety of the streets is about the same, at least the study in the 2000s said it was the same as the 70s, but parents don't think that. They don't believe it, right? It's not safe out there. So now there is a movement, though, to have playgrounds that have a lot of risk in them, that have fire in them, that have sharp objects like old cars and old things, sticks and metal things, for kids to play in. They have some in Britain. They have some, I think, in Australia. I haven't heard if they exist in the States, but that's something that people are trying to give children, those experiences of being able to take risks without an adult saying, "No, no, no, no," and feel successful at it.
I mean, when you look at you look at the playgrounds from when we were younger, and they were basically lawsuits waiting to happen in many ways. And then a quick story about this. When I was about 5, I fell off a horse, and I got up, and it was no big deal. I mean, I had fallen off of plenty of horses before, but But I remember there were some adults around this time, and they started making a big deal. And I remember I started crying, not because I was hurt, but because their response made me think that this was a bigger deal than it was.
That's right. Yeah, happens all the time.
So what does this have to do with beavers? Because in the book you talk about beavers and free play.
Well, beavers, we always think of beavers as hard workers, right? They're always doing stuff. They're chopping down the tree, making the lodge, making a dam, and actually even feeding other animals during the winter, housing them there, mice and such. But they play a lot too. They're out there playing, they're learning again. This is the way a mammal learns to get along with others is through free play. So I think that's another role model for us to realize that the natural world is full of play. It's the way persons, non-human persons get along and learn how to be cooperative. And we can do that too.
So, I would like for you to talk about, if you don't mind, wolves and then also morality. This is one of the things I love about your work is just the discussions of morality, and morality is very important to my work too, and it's very important to life. And also, morality gets kind of a bad rap in terms of, sort of a lot of lefties will sneer at morality and say, oh, that's just Christians want to do that. And then the sort of fundamentalist Christian morality is messed up on its own level. So we end up with morality ends up being this sort of big mess when it's really how we should live together. And you do a wonderful job of discussing that. So I should just shut up and let you talk.
Hey, I wanted to say I really loved your book, Myth of Human Supremacy. I had my class read it. It was great.
Oh, thank you.
So I think that's involved here too, right? Because this book has role models of other animals, right? That we're part of the animal kingdom. And these people, these persons, non-human persons, have a lot to teach us. And the wolves are part of that. Wolves have been given a bad rap for whatever reason, in part because they've been competitors for the same kind of animals that humans eat. Perhaps that's where it comes from initially. It's hard to say, but they also demonstrate what we're calling moral commitment here. And what is that moral commitment? Well, it's the providing the evolved nest to the young so that they can actually grow into their full wolfness, their full humanity. Which reminds me, I don't think we put this in the book, but they're wolf children, children who were raised by wolves. It's sort of an indicator of how malleable a human is. A wolf could never be raised by humans and then look and act like a human, right? And very just doesn't happen. Whereas wolf children start to act like wolves. They bark and they have the language of the wolf. They eat their food the way the wolf does, and so on. So it really matters what the early experience is, and part of that affects our morality. So when you leave children unnested, undercared for, you're enhancing the old parts of the brain, the pre-human parts of the brain, the survival systems that we share with other animals. And when you enhance those, you're actually at the same time under developing those social capacities for relational attunement, to be able to be flexibly attuned and develop a unique experience with every person you meet in that unique situation. And you're unable then to actually move away from your self-centeredness, as we were talking about before. And what we see with the wolves is they have this engagement ethic. They're socially engaged. They know that they have to be there for their young in order for their young to thrive. And we somehow have forgotten that. We now tell moms, mothering doesn't really matter, right? Parenting doesn't matter. The commitment to the well-being of your child is like, out of your hands anyway, right? So we have this very backwards idea of what morality is. We think now it's what you learn in school. It's the information. It's the ideology. It's the set of beliefs. It's something in your intellect that you apply to your behavior. But no, morality comes from the bottom up. It's how well your whole systems come together. You're regulated. So I talk about moral virtue then. It's to be a moral person, to be an ethical person, I use both terms the same way, is to have your heart, your mind, your gut, and your capacities all coordinated in the moment so that you can actually be present, fully present emotionally, cognitively, with the other and enhance their well-being. And that's what we see in our ancestral context with the pre-conquest nomadic foragers. They are able to do this. It's just amazing what they can do, how they are able to pick up on the needs of the other and meet those needs without any communication, verbal communication. And so that's what we're missing now, because we forgot that we can thrive. We can develop children who flourish if we provide this evolved nest and keep it going throughout our lives so that we all feel like we belong, we matter, we're connected, and we're part of the Earth community.
Well, thank you for that. And I'm thinking of Aldo Leopold's line about a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. And I'm going to throw this to you and say, a thing is moral when... and then let you finish that.
A thing is moral when it attends to the well-being of the biotic community, the wholeness, the enhancement, the flourishing of the planetary community. And that starts with your local community, right? To help, you have to know your local plants and animals and how they flourish and, you know, maintain a healthy soil and water and air in order for all to flourish in that area. So morality starts with your behavior and your ability to be fully present and effectively enhancing the others.
Thank you for that. I would, at some point, I would love to do an interview with you that is all about morality and about postmodernism. And the reason is because you do such great work on this. And there was a conversation I had. I've written about this in a couple books. Many, many years, three decades ago, I had a conversation with a friend who was dating a postmodern philosopher. And I said that rape is a bad thing. And she said, no, we can say rape is a bad thing, but it's all based on the stories we tell each other. So it's a sort of classic postmodern thing. And Charlene Sprutnak's State of Grace, book of States of Grace, or State of Grace, helped me wend my way through. I was flabbergasted. I didn't have an answer until I read and talked to Charlene Sprutnak. And I think you would have just wonderful things to say about an embodied morality, which I think is one of the most important things we can talk about in the world.
Yeah, that's fundamental. And we just forgot it.
So we have about 5 minutes left. And what, given that we live in modern capitalism, and given that we live with families spread across the globe, so that we don't have the necessary connections to all the relatives, all the local community, what can people, what do you want people to get out of this book? And what do you want for, and what can people do given that we live in this current larger social system?
I think we have to establish supportive communities wherever we are. So that means to connect with your neighbors, to find ways to, before you have your child, for example, to find, develop a support system. And then those of us who don't have young children, to move into ways of supporting the children around us. So every neighborhood should have a playground for children where children can run and play on their own. So there shouldn't be any laws against having unsupervised children out in the outdoors, which some communities have in the States, right? And they rest the parents. It's crazy. We have to get used to letting people have freedom. We have so little freedom anymore. We think we have freedom because we can pick which cereal we want to buy out of 100. That's not freedom. That's an illusion. So we have to get back to understanding what basic needs are that we have, and that means the freedom to run around and connect to others and all sorts of others, the natural world others, and to provide ways to do that for everybody at every age. And there's a lot to do. That means we have to move away from wage labor and forced, really slavery, and let people have multiple families, generations and households. Well, that's another, thing that's been pushed on us to only have single family dwellings, instead of multiple generations in a household. Many, many things at various levels. So wherever people are, if they understand the evolved nest, they can work in their area to support it. So at schools, have multiple age classrooms and don't have such rigid, use more of the Finnish school approach, which is where the child gets to pick what they're going to do. They get to direct their learning. As much as possible, we let children developmentally appropriately direct their lives instead of treating them like slaves to the system.
And so, last question. When will your book be available, and how much? I mean, not how much, but how can people get it?
It'll be available August 8th. There's Audible version, an e-version, and a hard copy version, and Amazon has it. You can pre-order it there. And we'll have a little movie that comes out with it on the Evolved Nest we're working on. I also have a new movie that's ready that I'm going to launch on June 20th called Reimagining Humanity. 12 minutes. 12 minutes.
What is it called again, and how can people watch it?
Reimagining Humanity. So after June 20th, you can just Google that or put in www.reimagininghumanity.org and it'll take you there.
Well, thank you so much for your work in the world, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Darshan Narvaez. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.